Welcome to the Game History Podcast, featuring interviews with some of the most renowned authors and up-and-coming talent in LGBTQ mysteries, suspense, and thrillers. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation. Hello. Unfortunately, due to technical difficulties, Justine won't be here this week to do her recommendation, but I did want to give a shout-out to Garrett Hudson. He's our newest Patreon member. Garrett, it's much appreciated. Thank you for helping. If you'd like to help support the show, all you need to do is go to patreon.com/gamemysterypodcast, and you can help us out with a donation as little as $2 a month. And now, my interview with Jess Faraday. If you enjoy hearing from LGBTQ crime fiction writers and would like to support this podcast, go to www.patreon.com/gaymysterypodcast. Jess Faraday is an award-winning writer and editor of mystery and suspense. Her first novel, The Affair of the Porcelain Dog, was shortlisted for a Lambda Literary Award, and her third, Fool's Gold, won the Rainbow Award for Best Gay Historical and was a runner-up for Best Gay Novel overall. Her novella, The Strange Case of the Big Sur Benefactor, was both a GCLS finalist and a Rainbow Award winner for Lesbian Historical. When not writing, she moonlights as the mystery editor for Elm Books, chases cryptids, and runs the hills and trails of the Scottish countryside. Jess, before we begin, you had previously mentioned you were spending one day a week sewing scrubs for the National Health Service, or NHS. Are you
That's
still
correct.
Doing that?
I what, am, yes.
What a wonderful thing to do. So,
well,
you go ahead.
You know, I was looking for some way to help, and that was a skill that I had, and it was easy, and they provided the material, and it's fun, so.
Well, good, and thank you on behalf of many people, and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, how are things in Scotland these days?
Oh, well, you know, it's... We're having beautiful weather for once. Not allowed to leave the house more than once a day, but the weather is gorgeous, so it's kind of frustrating.
We have the same situation in Southern California. We actually are allowed to leave more than once a day, but it's still mostly it's looking out the window at the beautiful sky.
Oh,
so I can understand.
Yes.
Especially in Scotland, having a sunny day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's the most we've been here for 3 years, and it's the most beautiful spring since we arrived here. And we can't take as good advantage of it as we want to.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your Simon Pierce mystery series.
Okay.
Let's start by what type of person is Simon Pierce?
I would say he's very much in his own head and his own thoughts. He's very logical and intellectual, and but really doesn't have a clue emotionally or about relationships, and that's where his growth comes from in the story.
Well, being in his own head and his own thoughts seems like it would be good for solving mysteries.
Absolutely.
Or is it a hindrance?
No, absolutely.
Okay, it's just the personal side that is a little bit troubled.
Yes.
Well, your latest Simon Pierce book is Shadow of Justice, which came out just over a month ago. Mm-hmm. How is that different than your other Pierce novels?
This was the first collection of short stories that I've done, and it's 8 stories. They're all a little bit less than 15,000 words with a personal arc that runs through it. And that is the first collection that I've done. Before that, I had done novels and one-off short stories.
Short stories are a challenge for me, so good on you that you're able to do those.
It was a huge learning curve, learning how to write in short form, because you have to get everything done. You don't have enough time. There are the same amount of time that you would writing a novel to get everything into a short story. It requires a different use of language and an economy of language that I wasn't used to. It was difficult but fun.
Well, that and limiting the number of characters and locations as well.
Yes,
I think it'd be difficult.
Yes, absolutely. Although I try to limit the number of characters that I work with in a novel too, because more than five main recurring characters and it just becomes unwieldy.
You're right. I'm actually, I just recently finished a novel that had a lot of characters, and halfway through I'm like, now who was that again? it is a bit much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, if you could go somewhere with Simon, where would you go?
Gosh. Well, you know, I live in Edinburgh, and I would love for him to show me his Edinburgh a little bit more than I've seen it already.
And his Edinburgh is a different time.
Definitely. Definitely. Late 1880s. And it was quite an interesting time in Edinburgh. Edinburgh has a very interesting and impressive intellectual and scientific history. It's very exciting, and I would have loved to have been around then to see it in real time.
Well, I presume that you've done a lot of research.
Oh, yeah.
What is the most surprising or funny thing you've learned about in your research?
Oh, wow. All right, this wasn't research for this book. This was actually research for my porcelain dog. But sure. I was researching the history of Scotland Yard. And that led me to the history of the Paris police, which figured into my second novel, The Left Hand of Justice. And I learned that the original Paris police in 1812 had a large number of female operatives because they could go places that male operatives couldn't get into and talk to people, and people didn't suspect them. They were undercover of being police operatives. That was a revelation to me.
Well, that's interesting, surprising, and smart. Now, if you went to Old Edinburgh with Simon, what would you talk about?
Ooh.
Well, you know him better than anyone else.
Yes. I'm not really sure. I'm sorry. I don't really.
That's okay. You can let him do all the talking.
Okay. I would love to know what he thinks of the nature and the weather, because it is very much the nature and the weather in Scotland is very much in your face at all times. And he is from London and had never left London before he was in his mid-20s and was, you know, had never been out of the city before. And I would like to know what he thought about that.
Well, would you say you love your characters?
Absolutely.
What do you love about them?
I like getting to know them because they really are their own individual entities. I don't sit down and say, I'm going to write a character like this. They kind of come up to me and say, hey, I've got a story. Would you like to hear it? Or in Simon's case, he didn't want to tell me the story. And I had to keep nagging him until he would let it out bit by bit. And some characters like Ira Adler want to tell you everything all at once and they never stop talking. And then some of them, like Simon, you really have to work at it. And it's always interesting to see who is going to be what kind of person and why they got to be that way and that.
You never know how stubborn they're going to be.
No, it's true.
And some of them, you think you're going in one direction and then they change it on you.
They absolutely do. There was recently an interview with authors at the Edinburgh Festival of Books, and 61% said that they talked to their characters, and ever so slightly less than that said that they believe that their characters have full agency and that the author is not really in control. And I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that.
Yes.
Now, we kind of alluded to the past in looking at your novels, the Simon Pierce series, The Affair of the Porcelain Dog, mm-hmm. The Strange Case of the Big Sir Benefactor, and Fool's Gold, just to name a few.
Uh-huh.
With rare exception, they all take place during the Victorian era.
Yes.
What is it about that era that interests you so much?
You know, it was such a time of contradictions. It was such a time of progress intellectually and scientifically. And at the same time, there was this incredible set of inequalities, set of social inequalities. And it always interests me to think about how people got on with their lives in such a stratified and difficult system. And at the same time, all of this progress was happening. And it must have been very, very exciting. And it just seems like a very exciting and interesting time to me.
Are you able to work those contradictions into your novels?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Actually, The Affair of the Porcelain Dog, one of the stories behind that was an argument I had with somebody on the internet. You know, you can never, if somebody is wrong on the internet, you always have to address that and let them know. But somebody made the remark that if you're writing in the Victorian era, it just doesn't make any sense to not write a character who is rich and male and white, because nobody else had agency of any kind, he argued, and you know, they just didn't have any stories. And that made me so mad. That was part of the impetus for writing that book, was saying, well, actually, you're wrong, and I'll show you.
That's terrible.
It is terrible. It is terrible. And I can report that this person is still unpublished. So,
you know, there is a list of how to write a mystery, and I wish I could remember who wrote it, but it was during the early 1900s that it was written. And one of the rules is that it cannot be a servant that committed the crime, because it must be a person of worth. And I read that, and I'm like, oh my god, that's terrible.
Wow. Yeah. Besides, the butler always does it.
Of course.
And in Porcelain Dog, I did have a butler who did it. So.
Oh, now, see,
not the major crime. Not the
okay,
major.
Okay. Crime. Okay. Good. You gave away your ending, but no.
Other crimes.
Okay. Yeah. One day I will write one where the butler did it, because I think nobody expects that.
That's right.
So what are some of the unique challenges you faced writing about a period that was over 120 years ago?
Well, always the research, figuring out technology. You have to have a really good handle on the technologies available at the time and how that affects things. Things people might not even think about, such as lighting. How did people light? How people lit the streets and lit the their homes. It was much, and heating, it was much different in the early 1800s from the late 1800s, for example. And what did gaslight look like? What kind of a shadow did it cast? What color was the light? And these are the little research details that make a setting come alive.
Well, you get me excited, because it really sounds like you get into those nitty-gritty details.
I do. I love to put myself in each scene and look around and feel the air temperature and the smells and see what it looks like and what are the sounds, and bring the story to life that way.
And definitely an exciting period. Well, we kind of live in a similar period, but it was definitely an
exciting period. Oh, gosh. It's exciting anyway.
Well, I'm just thinking about from black and white. I lived from black and white TV to now, you know, the miracle that is modern science. And they really went through the same period back then. I would think somebody that was born in 1850 that lived to be 80 years old, what a fascinating time period that would have been.
Wow. Yeah, it must have been. It must have been.
Yeah, it just bowls me over. We're going to take a quick break here.
All right.
Because we're going to do awkward questions authors get.
Oh, boy.
Now, what this is sometimes they're questions that are just hard to answer. Sometimes they're downright rude. But there are questions that we get that are, or may get that are not necessarily always easy to answer. So if you sit back, I'm going to spin the wheel.
All right.
And here we go. Okay. Yours is kind of unusual, but not a tough one. I know that all riders have cats. How many do you have?
I have one.
Just one? What's
yes. Her name is Oreo. She's a black and white.
What a perfect name for a cat, Oreo. She have a fun personality?
She is. She's very tough. She was a stray. And I got her because we lived in LA and we had a mouse and rat problem. And we got an exterminator in and they really did not do a whole lot. And my husband said, well, why don't we get a cat? And I thought, well, all right. And I had in mind one of the feral cat rescue, you know, working cats with a peg leg and one eye and, you know, go in there and kick some rat butt. But we ended up going to the shelter and he said, well, let's get this kitten. And it was a 1 pound kitten. I said, are you kidding me? But we brought this kitten home and we were rodent free in 2 weeks.
Wow.
She was a 1 pound, 4 month old kitten. And she had my 100 pound German Shepherd scared. And, you know, and she's kind of a one person cat. She likes me. She won't really cuddle with anyone else. And we're rodent free here too. So, but she's tough and she's a one person cat. That's her personality.
Well, you know, she may have been young, but I always say if a cat doesn't run and stands its ground, it almost always will win against the dog.
Yeah, I think so. Well, you know, some dogs are cat killers. Mine is
not.
Well,
that's true.
But he's a big marshmallow. But
oh, you have a dog too?
Yes. Yeah, he's a big old German Shepherd mix.
Well, you don't just love Oreo or your German Shepherd. You have a general love of animals, and
yes,
you're a longtime vegetarian and animal rights supporter.
That's right.
Let's talk more about that. Tell me more.
Okay. Let me see. Oh, where would you, I'm sorry. I don't know where to start with that. Where would you like me to go with that?
When did you become a vegetarian? What was the process?
Well, I always kind of felt that it was the right thing to do. And my role model was my grandmother, and she was, this is interesting. She and her husband way, way, way back when owned a butcher shop, and they both joined a religion called Sant Mat, which comes from India, and it's a yogic religion. And he realized that if he wanted to follow this religion as far as it would go, he would have to give up his livelihood. And so he didn't do that, but she went all the way with it and became the vegetarian and still did the books for the butcher shop, but she was always my role model, and she was never intrusive about it or pushy about it. And we would have large family dinners every week, and she would cook meat for everyone else and then have her little soy patty and rice. And I always thought that was a really friendly way of doing it. It was being a good example. She was never strident or pushy about it. And actually, that much of that half of my family is vegetarian, and many of them follow that religion also. I do not, but I did take the vegetarianism.
Well, you were talking about contradictions earlier to be a vegetarian and doing the books at a at a butcher shop. That's pretty funny.
Well, you know, back then people didn't have a lot of different options for moving careers. She had left school at age 13 because her mother had died, and she raised her many younger brothers and sisters and then went to work in the butcher shop. So it wasn't like, you know, she had a liberal arts degree and could do this or switch to do that, or like a lot of people can now.
Well, yeah, a liberal arts degree back then pretty much got you almost as far as it does today, which is not very. Well, in addition to writing, sewing, and your work with animals and your vegetarianism, you mm-hmm. are quite the athlete, aren't you?
Well, I enjoy doing sports. I would not say that I'm super great at them, or I wouldn't call myself an athlete either, but I do enjoy doing sports, yeah.
Well, if you enjoy them, you're way ahead of me. when did you begin Taekwondo?
Now, I began that when I was 8 years old. My parents did it, and I always wanted to do it. I always thought it would be really cool, but they wouldn't take students under eight. And so I pestered my mom and pestered her until I turned eight, and she signed me up. And I did it for a while, and then I quit when I was a teenager, and I went back to it as an adult, and I've been back for about 10 years. And I have my third degree black belt, and I enjoy it.
I was about to ask you what level you've reached, third degree mm-hmm. black belt. Well, I don't want to mess with you.
No, it's just, it's something fun. I have my friends and I go and I work out with my friends and keep fit, and I'm not that tough.
Well, I don't know. I don't know about that. Well, you're also a runner.
Uh-huh.
And you have a rather ambitious goal.
Uh-huh.
Let's talk about that.
Okay. Well, last year I ran my first half marathon. I had been running shorter distances for several years, but whenever I have any sort of stress in my life or anything is bothering me, I always set myself a physical challenge. And I had a number of stressful things in my life at that time that have since resolved themselves favorably. But I said, you know, the heck with this, I'm going to run a half marathon. And so I started training for that, and I downloaded a little program, and I ran the Edinburgh half marathon last May, and it was great. And it's pretty popular running and race running in Scotland, and I would love to run half marathons all over Scotland. That's kind of my goal right now, if they ever start having them again.
Well, let's hope eventually that does happen again.
Now, I hope so.
Do you live in Edinburgh?
I do, yeah.
Now, it's narrow streets, isn't it? Or
Some of the streets are narrow. In the center of town, they're narrow cobblestone streets, but as it sprawls out for quite a way in all directions, and you get the wider streets, relatively speaking.
Okay.
I'm kind of out on the southern fringe, and there are a lot of wide streets and farms and things like that where I am.
Well, I'm kind of American-centric, so we tend to think of London and cities like Edinburgh as still cobblestone streets and tiny little alleyways. And
We have those.
but we forget that it grows like any other city.
Yeah.
Okay, because I was wondering, how do you run in those narrow little streets?
It's actually really cool because it's beautiful, and you can run by the castle, and there are all the old buildings, and it's nice. I have about 10 different routes, training routes, and a number of them go through the center of town, and I really enjoy those.
Well, let's talk about reviews.
Okay.
Now, I noticed in some of the reviews of your books, almost all of which are good, some people, even the ones that gave you really good reviews, but they found it necessary to emphasize the book was not a romance.
Yes.
What are your feelings about people's expectations like that?
You know, I don't even know what to say to that, because my publishers market the books as mysteries. I call them mysteries. I say I'm a mystery writer, and they somehow seem to think that because there are two men in it, it needs to have a romance and lots of sex. And I don't write graphic sex. And the romance is usually a subplot rather than the major plot. And some people cannot get past that. And, you know, all right, you didn't read the product description. I don't know what to say. Yeah,
I've read your blurbs. There's nothing in there that would make me think it was anything other than a mystery.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're not the only one. I'm not going to name a name, but I know a very popular mystery author who, when I read his reviews on Goodreads, it was over and over again, well, there's no romance, but and it was over and over, and I'm like, just because there's gay characters doesn't mean there's going to be romance, and doesn't mean there's going to be sex.
I know.
You know.
I know.
So, well, good on you.
Well,
now we love great reviews.
Okay.
But is there anything that you may have learned from what you may consider a negative one or and incorporated into your writing?
Let me see. There was one review of my first book, and the reviewer really objected to the way I treated one of the characters. And, you know, basically this character, his heart was broken and he was a nice character, but he had some sad things happen to him. And the reader felt that he didn't get his, this minor character didn't get his happy ending and was very upset about that. And I've taken that on board, and I try to treat my characters a little bit more gently after that, because I think he was right. It was a good character, and he does eventually get his happy ending, but it's not in the first book. And it's one of the characters in Shadow of Justice also does not get a happy ending quite yet. He doesn't get a bad ending, but I am writing his happy ending right now. So,
and we've talked about happy endings on the show quite a bit, because I like not knowing if there's going to be a happy ending. I don't want to be guaranteed one, just because I don't want to be guaranteed what the book is, what's going to happen in the book. But I think especially during these times, people are looking for that happy ending. But, you know, there aren't always, some people don't have those.
No, that's true. That's true. One thing I will never write is a bummer ending. I will never finish a book with the bad guy winning or, you know, a hopeless ending, because I hate reading that, and I won't inflict that on readers either.
Yeah, you finish a book and you're like, what the hell?
Why did I read this? Why did I waste my time reading this? So, you know, it won't always be happily ever after, you know, happy, happy, joy, joy. It may be a bittersweet ending, but it will never be a bummer ending.
Well, what's the most rewarding thing you've heard from a reader?
You know, I've had a couple of people write to me and just say how much they really liked the character or really liked the story or that it meant a lot to them. And that always makes it worth it.
Yeah, you know, I think there's great reviews are wonderful, but when an author or when a reader actually goes out of their way to send you either an email or I've also gotten messages on Facebook Messenger, it just means so much.
Oh, yeah.
And I think a lot of people are very timid to do so. They're like, oh, the writer's too busy. But it really makes it worth it.
Yeah, I'll send other authors, you know, thank you letters or I really loved your book or whatever. And I always feel a little shy and self-conscious doing it. But if somebody wrote something that touched you, I don't think it's ever wrong to tell them thank you, you know, to let them know.
Are you familiar with Sue Grafton?
I am. Oh, yes.
Okay. Yeah. You know, she was mega huge and unfortunately she's not with us anymore, but
yeah,
she was mega huge. She wrote the Alphabet series. A is for Alibi, B is for Burglar, I think it was. Anyway, when I was just starting as a writer, I had a curiosity question about writing, and I actually sent her, well, I sent emails to quite a few writers and I was really surprised how many were very generous with their time and answered my questions. I didn't bug them over and over and over again. I made sure I distributed it evenly amongst the writers. But I was surprised I got a response from Sue. Now, it wasn't from Sue herself. It was from her son-in-law who worked for her. But the fact that even I got that surprised
me. Wow.
So for you readers out there, don't hesitate to contact the writer and let them know what you think. Because we love it.
Yeah, unless it's bad. Don't contact me with bad. I don't want to hear that.
Well, I'd rather they contact me with bad than write the review. You know, send me a suggestion as to what could have been better. But yeah, definitely a good point. Now, most of your books, except for a few, I think have been series novels. Some of them were just maybe a two-series novel. And Simon Pierce, you're on the fifth book.
Let me see. Simon Pierce, there were eight novelettes.
Oh, novelettes,
and
too.
Yeah, the 15,000 word longish short stories. And then Ira Adler had three books, and the others are one-offs.
Well, what is a particular challenging thing about writing a book series?
I guess coming up with further stories and further adventures, but I don't really find that a challenge. Once I get into the rhythm of writing a book, I have so much fun with the characters, I don't want to stop writing stories for them. So maybe the challenge is not writing more.
Do you have a challenge keeping your characters within character?
No, because I feel like they're revealing themselves to me. If I say this one is going to do this now, a lot of times they'll say no. No, I'm not going to do that. and they're right. And, you know, a challenge that I'm having with my current work in progress is that there's a lot of characters are coming out of the woodwork and kind of jostling to be the main one. And it's becoming very unwieldy. I have to kind of tamp them down a little bit and say, okay, now it's your turn to speak. No, you be quiet over here. Now you speak. And
you can't all get attention at the same time.
That's right. That's
like working right. with a classroom full of children.
Oh my gosh, it can be.
Well, Jess, I got to tell you, time flies.
It does.
It is. We have reached the end of the show.
Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you. It was so much fun.
Well, I really enjoyed it. I had a good time talking with you. And as I say with many of my guests, that you know, I could just go on forever.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you. Hit the subscribe button wherever you hear our show so you don't miss a single episode. Tell a friend, too. Thank you for listening.